Welcome to the Make It Happen with Will Polston podcast. These podcast episodes with Will and his guests provide you with insights on how you can transform your excuses into results to benefit yourself, your family, your friends, your community, society, humanity, and the universe with what Will calls the ripple effect. Will's mission is to empower 1 billion people via the ripple effect and intends that you'll become another person to add to the count, having listened to this episode.
Hello and welcome to Make It Happen with Will Polston. I'm Will Polston. This is episode number 112, and in this episode I'm delighted to be joined by Neil Donald Walsh. Neil has written 39 books on contemporary spirituality and its practical application in everyday life, including the 9-book Conversations with God series that has sold over 15 million copies and translated into 37 languages. His latest book is The God Solution, and in this episode we're going to be talking about contemporary spirituality, the God Dilemma, The God Solution, and Idea Heroes. So Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Will. It's lovely to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to share this time with you.
So you have been a thought leader in contemporary spirituality for many, many years now. And what I think is incredible about your particular approach is you have created this way of thinking for people, this way of thinking spiritually that has a very practical application as well. As we've just heard, I mean, you've had some phenomenal success for many, many years. Of course, your first books that have sort of had a extreme success are Conversations with God. What I would love to start with is, what is contemporary spirituality?
I think it's a mixture of present day practical thinking about the exigencies of life, the necessities and the challenges of everyday life, and the highest hopes and the highest dreams and the highest thoughts that many people hold, you know, inside of them when they're giving thought to life itself. And so what I think that today's spirituality, what I call practical spirituality, is about, it's about melding and bringing together those two elements, and then adding a third element, melding into those two elements what we imagine or hope that God is thinking or feeling about any particular circumstance, situation, event, or issue. Of course, naturally, when we talk about what is, you know, contemporary spirituality, we're talking about God. I mean, the contemporary spirituality presumes that there is some sort of higher power. And so some sort of controlling power, as the surveys put it. Recent surveys have shown, Will, most people don't know this, but recent surveys have shown, and these surveys were taken by anthropologists in most of the countries of the world over the past 2 years. They wanted to find out how many people feel that there is such a thing as a controlling power, something larger than us, something going on that's more than just us. And astonishingly, I mean, I was surprised when I saw the results myself. 8.5 out of 10 people agree that there is some sort of controlling power, something larger, something out there that's bigger than us. Call it God, call it Yahweh, Jehovah, Brahman, you know, Allah, whatever word you feel comfortable using to refer to that ineffable essence that we think of as the divine. So we have apparently come to an agreement that there is such a controlling power. There is such an, you know, energetic that exists in the universe. Ironically, we can't find our way to a place of agreement with regard to what it is specifically, what it wants, what it needs, what it requires, what it does if it doesn't get what it requires, and most importantly, how we can use it. If that power really exists, is it available for us to use? Is it accessible by us? Or is it just some kind of power that's out there, but we can't really use it? I like to use the analogy of gravity. Gravity is an energetic, it's a power, the power of gravity, but we've learned how to use it, interestingly enough. We didn't always, in the early days, we didn't know how to use it, but as the years went by, we learned how to actually harness the power of gravity to put it to use in ways that serve us. And so the question before the house now, the question before humanity, and what contemporary spirituality is about, is how to utilize that controlling or higher power that so many people agree exists. But it becomes a great big so what if we don't find a way to actually use it as a practical tool. You know, Will, I've often said publicly, a spirituality that has no practical application is bankrupt.
Mm.
I'm not interested. I can have all kinds of beliefs about God or about the saints or about this or about that, but if it doesn't have any real practical here and now application in my life, I'm not interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what contemporary spirituality is about is an approach to life that practicalizes God. Mm-hmm. Quite a book one day called Practicalizing God. It's got to be a good book title.
That's a book title. And if that comes out, I'm going to claim that happened. That moment was when we were having our interview.
Yeah, but you're not getting any other royalties.
So, well, I want to touch on that for a moment, because in conversation with God, you do mention the fact that you just did, that 8.5 out of 10 people believe in a higher power, like you say, call it the divine, God, Allah, the universe, whatever you want to call it, but only 2 out of 10 said that they felt they knew how to use it.
Yes, and of those who feel they know how to use it, probably only 1 out of 10 actually does use it.
Yeah.
That is, they might have the knowledge, but they don't actually use it.
Yeah.
I compare that to, you know, what I learned in school about mathematics. I got to tell you the truth, Will. I learned more mathematics in school than I will ever use for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I know about mathematics. I know certain mathematical formulas and all the rest. But the last time I actually used algebra was probably 70 years ago, you know, or maybe 50. But I mean, because, you know, so I have the knowledge, or at least I had it before I forgot it all. But I don't use it. So yes, probably two out of 10 people actually have the knowledge, and only 1 out of those people actually use it, which is why the world is the way it is.
We're going to be talking about that in detail today. Two things that I would like to ask off the bat. What for you personally, what is spirituality?
An energy that I can use, an energy that I am. Spirituality for me is a way of saying what I am.
Mm.
That is, I am a spiritual being. And spirituality, therefore, for me is the energy that fills my physical body, that brings into my physical body elements of spiritual awareness, wisdom, clarity. So spirituality for me is an energy that allows me to experience life as something much more than simply a physical encounter.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, I thought it was interesting to ask that, because we're going to go back a few years, if you don't mind, because you've got a quite a fascinating story. One of the things I love doing on the show here, when with all of the different guests that we have, is going back to sort of where things began, you know, once upon a time. And I know that for you personally, you did grow up in with very religious beliefs. I'm understanding you were Catholic.
Yes. My family raised me as a Roman Catholic boy. I went to a parochial school from the very earliest days, in the first grade, and I went through 8 years of parochial education. So, and that made me a very religious boy. I walked around, Will, with a crucifix that I wore. I mean, as a child, as an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, 10-year-old, I was so in love with God, so in love with Jesus. And I'm not making fun of myself. I'm really grateful, honestly, very grateful for those days, because it gave me a sense of what we're talking about here. It gave me a sense of something larger going on than just what was happening, in my day-to-day life. But I was very religious. I'd wear my crucifix, and I said my prayers religiously, and I listened very carefully when the priest came in on Wednesdays every week and taught catechism, which were the doctrines and the dogmas of the Catholic Church, teaching to third and fourth and fifth graders, and so I lived, and I was going to be a priest. I was convinced. I really wanted to be a priest. I wanted to be like Bing Crosby in Going My Way, in the wonderful movie. I wanted to be a Catholic priest. And that desire existed in me until I was around perhaps 14 years old, when I happened to chance upon a copy of Playboy magazine. And I opened the centerfold and I saw, this is a true story, we can chuckle about it, but it's true. I saw my first photograph of a lady with no clothes on. And I mean, all of her private parts were in the picture. It wasn't a discreet photograph. It was a very vivid photograph. And I saw this entire human being, female. And I thought, now, wait a minute. Are you saying that in order for me to be a priest, I will never experience anything more than this photograph? Well, I would like to just know more about that. And as I grew into my 15th and 16th and 17th year, I really realized that I couldn't understand, actually, Will, why would any church, I don't care what the religion is, why would any church require celibacy as a mandate in order for a person to serve God as a priest? Which reminds me of a wonderful story I've heard about the Pope, who, when he died, the last Pope, when he passed away, they said to him, Peter said to him at the pearly gates, Your Holiness, you've been such a wonderful human being that you are being given access to the celestial library. Not very many people have had access, but because of the exemplary way in which you've lived, you are going to be allowed to be in the celestial library for all eternity and learn all about what's written about God and life and how to live your life. And so the Pope was very excited, and he went into the library and spent his days, reading books, flowing through the material. And one day, Peter heard a cry from the library. No! Oh, no! No! And so he rushed in. Your Holiness, what's the matter? And the Pope was pointing to a book and to a word in the book. He said, there's an R. There's an R. And Peter said, there's an R. What do you mean? And the Pope said, it's celebrate. So I never could understand why I had to be celibate in order to be holy, in order to be a man of God. Because they seem to be at odds with each other, actually. That a man of God would be a person who lives the fullness of life. Mm. Not in a negative way, not in a way that's inappropriate, but certainly lives the wholeness of life and understands all there is to know about life. I could never understand, for instance, how a priest would give a couple counseling. Mm. How could he give a couple counseling when he doesn't even know, presumably, about the experience of being living with a person of the opposite gender. Mm. So, which is an interesting experience, I can tell you. So having done it and having been married seven times, I've discovered it's an interesting experience.
I could imagine. So
I've had seven wives. And when people hear that, their heads spin around. No, he's kidding. He's just joking. No, actually, it's true. I've had seven different spouses in my life. So I didn't just agree to become, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, or housemates, or companions with someone. I was not what you'd call an emotionally unavailable male. I was ready to put a ring on my finger and say, no, let's be serious about this. If we're going to be intimate with each other, and if we're going to pool our resources, and if we're going to share, you know, our hopes and dreams for the future, let's be serious about this. And I put, you know, rings on the fingers of seven different ladies, four of whom, now that I think about it, are no longer in their physical body. Nevertheless, it didn't stop me. The ending of those relationships, of those marriages, didn't stop me from continuing to be willing to make that kind of commitment. So yes, you're right. I had a very religious upbringing, but I began to look seriously at not only the doctrines of the Catholic Church, but the doctrines of religion in general.
Mm. And this is where I think it's interesting. So that experience when you were 14 years old with Playboy magazine, of all the magazines, created a curiosity that caused you to doubt the religion that you'd been brought up in and challenge some of the dogma around it. Is that fair to say?
Yes. It caused me to doubt not so much the religion that I was brought up in, but some of the teachings of the religion. Yeah. I never doubted God. Yeah. So in that sense, I didn't doubt what the primary message of the religion was. So I didn't doubt the existence of God, but I did doubt what I was being told about that God and what that God requires and in fact demands of us. I began to doubt that. And that really changed my life.
Because this is interesting, because I grew up, I wasn't particularly religious. I mean, I was christened and things like that. And then so when we had to do religious studies at school, I just thought, what a load of rubbish. There is no man sitting in the clouds with a gray beard and white hair that rules everybody, because that was
and glasses.
Funny, you look remarkably like the man. And there we go. But it's because that was the case and that was the image that I had, I just absolutely dismissed it for many, many, many years. And it's only in sort of more recent years where I've definitely become, as we would describe, spiritual, believing in a higher power, what that is, the energy of being able to harness energy and use it to our power. But I definitely wouldn't class myself as religious. So what I would love to hear from you as someone that's written books talking about God, literally conversations with God, I mean, I've sold tens of millions of copies. How do you differentiate the difference between being spiritual and being religious?
Well, I think you've just done it. Being religious, by most common definitions, is being attached to and adhering to and embracing certain doctrines and dogmas that are quite specific. And that can be very, very demanding and dogmatic, dogmas that are dogmatic. To give you a simple example, I was told when I was 9 years old that if I miss Mass on Sunday, I don't have a good excuse. And should I get hit by a car on Monday or through some tragedy, I would die. I would go directly to hell. And the priest told us this when I was 9 years old. I vividly remember it. I'm 9 years old and the priest is standing in front of the room telling us that you must go to Mass on Sunday, because if should you die and have missed Mass without a good excuse, you're going to go to hell. And I again, you know, like with the idea when I was 14 with the lady in Playboy, I'm thinking at the age of nine, let me see if I understand this. You wanted me to believe in a God that loves us profusely and loves us so much, but that if we miss Mass on Sunday and don't have a good excuse, we just decide to go play golf, or that we're going to go to hell if we die without confessing that sin. This is the God that you say loves us. So I got my first model of what love is about, because I was told by that message that, Neil, God's love is very conditional. Mm. You could write it out in this way. I love you if.
Mm.
I love you if you don't miss Mass on Sunday without a good excuse. Mm. I love you if you, and you, and all the ways that follow the word if. And then I learned, oh, then that's how we should love each other as well. I began to see that human beings are patterning their own behavior based on how they imagine and how they've been taught by religious authorities that God behaves. We're just imitating God's behavior, because God is judgmental, you know, condemning and punishing. If we don't do what God tells us we have to do. So, yeah, I had very interesting experiences with religion. And I began to see the difference, although I wouldn't have articulated it that way when I was 9 years old. But when I got to be toward 19 or 20, as I began to move more firmly into adulthood, I began to think, you know, there is a real difference between religion and spirituality. Religion appears to be a way of believing, a way of living, a belief system that are firmly based on dogmas and doctrines that have been passed on down to us through the centuries, and that comprise a particular manner of behaving on the planet. Whereas spirituality is more defined by me as a sense of connection with an energetic that exists in the universe that I am a part of, that is a part of me, and that exists throughout the cosmos. Mm. I see God as an energy that can take the form of any life expression that it chooses. I think that God is an energetic, an energy expression that is self-conscious, self-aware, and may in fact take the form of any physical object, including any entity, any sentient being in the cosmos, not just on Earth, but in the cosmos. So when I'm told that, you know, Jesus was a divine entity, the Son of God, God on Earth, I believe that. I don't think he was the only one.
Yeah, I mean, on that basis, you're saying that could be everyone.
Well, it is definitively everyone, but it's a question of who knows it and who behaves, who acts like it, who demonstrates their true identity. What sets Jesus apart from others is that he demonstrated his true identity. He accepted it. He embraced it. He demonstrated it. He even declared it. And he declared it much to his own disadvantage. I mean, Pontius Pilate said to him, you know, you gave him a chance to denounce it. You know, just because Pontius Pilate really didn't want to have to kill the guy. He said, you know, come on. He said to Jesus, come on, just let go of these ideas. Tell me you made a mistake and you can walk out of here a free man. But Jesus said, no, I can't tell you I made a mistake. I am divine. And Pilate said, okay, string him up. We'll have to crucify you. And even as he was being crucified, he said to his higher understanding of God, hey, you know what? You got to forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing.
Mm.
They don't even know what they're doing. So, yes, And Jesus himself said to us, by the way, why are you so amazed? When people would watch his miracles, he would look at them and say, why are you so amazed? These things and more shall you do also. Mm. He also said something else intriguing. He said, I and the Father are one, and we are brothers and sisters. So now, wait a minute, let me put that together. If I and the Father are one and we are brothers and sisters, then you and the Father are one as well.
Yeah.
And that's the great missing element. That's the difference between religion and spirituality. Religion says that we are not one with God, but that we are under God's control and under God's power. Whereas spirituality says, there's no separation between God and me. I am part of all that is, and God is all that is. And so by definition, I am simply an individuation of divinity. Now, to people who are deeply religious, that's apostasy. To say something like that is blasphemy. It's heresy. And some religions would actually kill you for saying that, even as they did in the days of Pontius Pilate. No, you don't get to say that. If you don't renounce, if you insist on saying that you and God are one, we're going to have to kill you. Not 2,000 years ago. There are religions that do that to this very day. There are also religions that prohibit you from even asking any questions. You're not supposed to question the dogma. It's unquestionably the truth. And if you dare to question the dogma, you can be brought up on ecclesiastical offenses and actually sentenced to prison or death, depending on how serious your offenses are. And of course, declaring that you and God are one would be the highest offense. So not much has changed in 2,000 years. And that's the difference between religion and spirituality.
I think that I love those definitions. And one of the things that we're going to be speaking about before we wrap up is your focus on really what we have the ability to do, the sort of the single statement of spiritual truth that could produce peace and happiness on the planet. And I think a lot of it can link into that. And we're going to come to that in a few moments. But I was out for dinner a few weeks ago with a dinner that we put on, and a friend of mine, Gary and Craig, we were having a conversation. They sat opposite me and I said that I'm going to be interviewing you. And they said, it'll be interesting to know, and I'm interested to know, you grew up as a Roman Catholic for many, many years. You've been doing this work now. What do you, for a start, identify as a religious person, as in any particular, do you practice any form of religion at all, of any kind these days?
Well, I think it's what I just said. I think I identify a religious person as a person who adheres to certain dogma, certain doctrines, certain messages and teachings that have been codified. Yeah. And by codified, I mean actually put down in writing as a series of statements. They're often contained in a book that's called the Holy Scripture for that religion. And there are, of course, many Holy Scriptures, not simply the Bible. There's the Bhagavad Gita and, you know, the Book of Mormon and the Quran and the Upanishads and many, many, many Holy Scriptures that presume or pronounce that they are the messages received, ironically, directly from God. Mm-hmm. So apparently God does have conversations with certain ones of us.
So
people have received these messages, presumably directly from source, capital S, and put them into books in which they have codified the so-called laws of God. And so I identify a religious person as a person who, by and large, pays attention to and obeys and lives according to those laws. Now, the tragedy of that is that that is precisely what has caused the world to be the way it is. Mm. That, interestingly enough, more wars, more killing has been done on this planet in the name of God than over any other particular issue. And because we have decided that God is righteous, and so therefore can we be righteous? And so we had, like, you know, hundreds of years of what are called the Crusades, and hundreds of years of, as well, members of the Muslim religion traveling across the countryside and requiring people to believe in a certain way and to pronounce certain promises as to who they are. So we've been using religion, and not just those two religions, but we've been using religions for years as a means of, interestingly enough, as a means of subjugating each other and requiring each other to behave in the way that we want them to behave, and which is exactly the opposite of what God would desire for us. Which leads to a fair question. If God doesn't want that to happen, why does she allow it? What's the matter with her? Why doesn't she just stop it? By the way, if in certain countries I actually called God a she, I would be in deep trouble. Because we all know that God has a penis. God does not have a vagina. So let's get real clear about that. So, but it raises the question, if there really is a God of whatever sex, why would God allow himself or herself, itself, to be so sadly misinterpreted, to be used as a means of killing each other? You know, why does God step in? I call that the God dilemma, Will. Mm. The God dilemma is, and not just about religious doctrine, by the way, about all of life. I mean, life on earth in many ways, forget about taking religion out of it for a minute, in many ways, life is a mess. We don't seem to be able to control ourselves. We don't seem to be able to create the life on this planet of which we are capable and which we say we desire. For lo, these many years, for these many centuries, we have found ourselves impotent, unable, utterly unable to create the life that we say we desire. If there is a God, why doesn't God just step in and say, hey, you know what? I'll fix it. You guys don't have to have a pandemic. I can fix the pandemic with one wave of my hand. It'll be gone tomorrow. Or why doesn't God cure the other ills that humanity has created for itself? Racial injustice, economic depravity, utter suffering, deep-seated poverty, you know, an unbelievable imbalance between the rich and the poor. I'm not sure many people know that probably eight or nine people who hold more wealth and resources than half of the human race combined. I'm not sure that there are many people who understand that 653 children die on this planet every hour of starvation. Starvation. 650 children every hour die of starvation. When we throw away enough food in the restaurants of Paris, London, New York, and Tokyo, then would be needed to feed an entire village in a third world country in a week. I'm not sure there are many people who realize that 1.5 billion people have not had a drop of pure water in their entire lives. In their entire lives. I'm not sure that there are many people who understand that 2.5 billion people still don't have indoor plumbing. They're relieving themselves outside. I don't think there are many people who understand that also 2 billion people, believe this or not, still do not have electricity. Electricity, which we discovered and learned how to harness and use a while ago. And yet we have billions of people who don't have something as simple as electricity. Forget about an ironing board or a washing machine or a dishwasher. Forget about even a light bulb. They're living by candlelight today. And by the way, in case you think I'm exaggerating this, I experienced it. I had the privilege a few years ago. Now I guess it's more than a few years. Time has been flying. But around 25 years ago, I was hired by the State Department of the United States to travel to developing nations around the world as part of a crew of people who were bringing space age technologies to developing nations around the world. And I visited, Will, a very remarkable place called Ouagadougou. It was a city in Upper Volta. And I was invited to spend an evening with some people who lived in Ouagadougou. And they took me to their home. It was really a mud hut made of just baked mud. Of course, it had no electricity, had no power. There weren't any light bulbs. There weren't any dishwashers or ironing boards. They didn't have any stoves to make food on. They had a fire outside that they they brought me into their home that evening. The house was about as big as a small apartment. I think there were 8 or 9 people living there. As I remember, there were 8 or 9 human beings living in that tiny little space. And in that evening, there was more laughter and more joy and more love being expressed between those people than I can remember ever experiencing in any group like that in my life. And I remember when I drove back to my hotel in Ouagadougou, thinking, what do they know that I don't know? What do they understand about life that I don't even understand? There's something they're aware of that I'm somehow become utterly disconnected from. And when I came back from Ouagadougou, I'm going to write a book one day. When I came back from Ouagadougou, it's got to be a great title. When I came back from Ouagadougou, I can tell you it was a long time before I became furious that I couldn't get, talking to the operator on the telephone. Operator, operator, what's the matter? I've been trying to get a call through to Los Angeles for the past 2.5 seconds. Why can't I make this connection? Because, in Ouagadougou, you waited 5 or 6 or 8 hours to get a phone line. In my hotel, you had to sign up for the phone line. And they would call you in your room and say, your phone line is available, Mr. Walsh. And you were given like 5 or 7 minutes to get done what you needed to get done on the telephone because there were 30 other people waiting for that telephone line. Wow. There's no college in the country that teaches stuff like that. You got to be on the ground in real life with real people to understand what's going on and who you really are, and how it can change your whole experience of life. So, I forgot what the question was you asked me.
It's been incredible because it's extremely insightful to us. But I suppose what I wanted to ask, well, it's my friend Craig and Gary that we're talking about it, is what religion do you identify as yourself now?
I don't. Yeah. No, I couldn't. No, it's impossible because religion is a decision. It's an organization that processes dogma and doctrine. So I don't belong to any religion.
But that's what I thought would be the case. I just wanted to clarify that we were curious. But the thing that you did mention when you were sharing about that was that these scriptures, these religious texts, an individual had a communication with God, the divine, and then it was put into a book. Now, you had, I understand, you had your own personal exchanges with the divine, which led to your first series of books. And for people that aren't familiar with the story, how did that come about?
I had, you know, what we would call a dark night of the soul. In my case, Will, I had what I often refer to, I suffered what I call the triple whammy. That is, everything in my life was falling apart at once. My career had reached an utter dead end, and I had actually been fired, not fired, but laid off from my job. So I had no job. My relationship had fallen apart at the exact same time. So I had, because most people, if they're, you know, maybe the relationship isn't going so well, but things are okay at work, or maybe, you know, work is not going so well, but things are okay at home. No, no. With me, it was both things at the exact same time in my life. Then, to make matters even more interesting, I had an automobile accident. An older gentleman drove right in front of me, crashed into my car. He turned in front of me for no apparent reason. He thought I could get across the lane, I guess, but he smashed right into me. I suffered a broken neck, not a couple of bruises or a bad, I had a broken neck. And by the way, it wasn't a hairline fracture. It was described, I remember the words vividly because I never forgot it. The report said that I suffered a 3/4 inch avulsion fracture of the 7th cervical vertebrae posteriorly. In other words, Will, the fracture in my neck was big enough to put a pencil through.
Wow.
3/4 inch avulsion fracture posteriorly. And what the doctor said to me when I was, of course, they took me to the hospital. And when I got in there, the surgeon looked at me and he said, "You do understand. You have no right to be alive." People who have that kind of a fracture where your neck, by the way, I remember when it happened. When the guy hit me, I heard it and felt it. And I went, "Oh, that can't be good. That can't be," because my head snapped. You see, I was driving. I had a seatbelt on, but my head just snapped because the collision was so powerful. And the surgeon looked at me and he said, "You're one in a million. Most people would die instantly with that kind of a fracture. Not only are you alive, you're not even paralyzed. You actually have movement in your arms and in your hands. I want you to consider yourself one of the luckiest people on the face of the earth. And it might be a good opportunity for you to decide what your life is really about. Because every minute you spend, much less any year you spend after this, is a total, outright gift." And I got it. I got it. But that's what caused me to have my conversation with God. Because it took me a year and a half to heal from that injury. I was walking around with what they call a Philadelphia collar. Don't ask me why they call it a Philadelphia collar, but they do call it that. It's a therapeutic collar that you wear around your neck and it holds your head up. And the doctor said, "You will not take this collar off at any time. Not to take a shower, not to sleep. You will not take this collar off at any time. Think of a basketball being held on the head of a pin. There's nothing holding your head up except this device, because your neck does not, until your neck fuses again, you will not take this collar off." Well, I couldn't get work. I was out of work, as I just explained. I had lost my job. I was downsized, but and I was willing to do anything. Will, I was going into food stores saying, "I'll sweep the floor. I'll stock the shelves. I'll clean the bathrooms. I'll do whatever you need. I need work. Just give me anything that would give me $50 a week." I couldn't find work because one guy was finally honest with me. He said, "Mr. Walsh, you're a walking insurance claim. We can't hire you with that thing around your neck. One wrong move and we're paying your insurance bills, your medical bills for the rest of your life. We can't hire you. Come back when you're healed from this injury. So I was unable to find work anywhere. I wound up having to live on the sidewalk. I couldn't pay my rent. The landlord said, you know, tough break. I'm sorry, but I got to ask you to leave. I wound up living on the street. I had nowhere to go. And I lived on the street, not for a tough couple of months, but for a whole year of my life. A year outside on the sidewalk.
With a broken neck.
With a broken neck and no income of any kind. And so I was reduced to going from person to person on the sidewalk saying, anything could help. Anything. A quarter, a dime, a nickel. Anything. If I can get enough people to give me a nickel, by the end of the day, I could buy a bag of French fries. And I can get through till tomorrow. I'll be sleeping on the street, but at least I'll have something in my stomach. And I lived that way for a year. I'm telling you, you want to have a life-changing experience. Go out on the sidewalk for a weekend. Forget about a year. Just do it from Friday till Monday. Decide not to wash, not to bathe, not to eat, and take all the money out of your pocket and go out on the sidewalk on Friday afternoon and don't come home till Monday night. Tell me how it was. Tell me how it went for you. Tell me how it was to go up to people and ask them for any kind of help at all. And then after you do that for a weekend, come back and do it for a year. And let me know how it affected your life. Well, it caused me to write an angry letter to God. I just wrote a very angry letter. What does it take to make life work? I'll play. I promise I'll play the game. Just give me the rules. And after you give me the rules, don't change them. Because the rules were changing from week to week, from month to month. I don't understand what's going on here. And so I wrote a very angry letter to God one night. I woke up. I finally found a way. I got a little part-time job at a radio station. I was a radio announcer, and I got a little job at a radio station, a weekend fill-in, and I was making $50 a week. You know, that's $200 a month, which was enough for me to, in those days, this is 25 years ago, which is enough for me to, actually 30 years ago, which is enough for me to survive, but not do much more. I could put a couple of cans of pork and beans in the refrigerator, I mean, in the pantry, and maybe a loaf of bread in the refrigerator. That was about it. And I could afford, and I found a little one room apartment in the back of someone's property, a little grandma in-law apartment, whatever. And it was one room, but I wound up staying there. And that's when I woke up one night at 4:30 in the morning, and I found a yellow legal pad on the coffee table in front of me. And I began writing a very angry letter to God. What do you want from me? What do you want from me? What does it take to make life work? And what have I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? Oh, I got it. I left the church. I left the Catholic Church. Now I remember. Yeah, of course. You're getting me back. Revenge is
you engulfed that Sunday.
Yeah. Revenge is mine, saith the Lord. So I wrote this angry letter to God. But Will, I heard a voice over my right shoulder. Sure as I'm hearing yours now, I heard a voice over my right shoulder. And it said, Neil, do you really want answers to all of these questions? Or are you just venting? Of course, I turned around, there's nobody there. And I'm thinking, great. Not only is my life falling apart, now I'm going crazy. I'm hearing voices. Terrific. But I thought about what I heard and I said, well, yeah, I am venting. You think? I am venting. what the hell is going on here? And I started in my mind receiving answers to every question I asked. Every question I could think of, the answer would come to me so fast I couldn't even write it down. I was writing it down because I was realizing, wait a minute, I want to keep a record of this. So I was writing down what I was hearing. And then I would ask another question, writing down what I was hearing. And what I was hearing was sponsoring other questions. And pretty soon I got into question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. And before I knew it, I had pages and pages and pages of handwritten questions and answers, which ultimately became a book called Conversations with God, which is exactly what I thought I was having at that point. Because what I was being told were things I've never dreamt of, never heard of, never believed, never thought of. So far outside the box that I really did think, okay, I'm losing my mind. But it was helping me get through the days and nights. It was bringing tears to my eyes because I was thinking, wow, wouldn't it be neat if these things were true? And that voice in my mind was saying, they are, sweetheart, they are. Keep talking. Keep asking. And I'll give you whatever answers you want. And I asked questions, Will, about everything. God, life, love, sex, right livelihood, parenting, dieting. I mean, I just asked about everything that I could think of. And I received answers, the likes of which I never would have imagined. I just kept on writing furiously. And of course, it was a very personal, sacred experience. I never imagined that anybody in the world would ever see any of this writing but me. It never even occurred to me. I wasn't writing a book. I was having a sacred encounter. I thought of it kind of like journaling, spiritual journaling, keeping a diary, whatever. But I never thought anyone would ever see what I was writing. But then I was told in the dialogue, you will make of this a book, and it will be accessed by many people. And I thought, ha, ha, now I got you. Now I got you. Whoever this is that's talking to me, because that's measurable. Everything else that we've been discussing, theoretical, conceptual, could be, could not be. Who would know? Who would know? But now you've made a statement of fact. This will become a book and it will be accessed by many people. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen. I'll send these handwritten notes to a publishing house. I can just see the owner of the publishing house going out to the workroom floor and saying to his editors, hold the presses. I got a guy here who's talking to God. It's not going to happen. So I sent it to a publisher on a dare. Daring God. Nobody's going to publish a book from some wacko in Oregon who thinks he's talking to God. Except they did. And it sold 15 million copies in 37 languages. Okay. Okay. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
And it's an incredible, incredible story. And thank you so much for sharing that. So you had this profound, incredible experience that's impacted millions of people. And then more recently, you've decided to write a phenomenal book called The God Solution. And one of the things that you share in the book is what God is and how you define God, which in your words is pure love, a powerful, game-changing, impactful force.
Yeah, I should explain that the book, The God Solution, is not a dialogue. It's not a question and answer book where I'm asking God questions. It's really the apotheosis of the Conversations with God encounter. It's the culmination. I tried to pull together in one short book, a relatively short book. It's not a big, big, fat, thick book. It's a relatively short book, 110 or 120 pages. So you can read it in a couple of hours. But I wanted to find a way to just condense and become very precise about what it is that I've come to understand about who and what God is and how we can use that energy in our lives. But it's not the first attempt that I've made to do that. You may or may not know that I've written actually 39 books. And this is my 39th book. Nine of them were dialogue books. 30 of them were books that extrapolated on, expanded the messages and explored more deeply what I was coming to understand in those nine dialogue books. So, yes, the God Solution talks about redefining God, that what that the solution to our, and by the way, I called it the God Solution because of what I mentioned earlier about the God Dilemma. The book starts off by asking, if there really is a God, why is the world such a mess? And why are so many lives the way they are? Why are we constantly confronting these kinds of difficulties and challenges? Not just the pandemic, not just the events of most recent times, throughout human history, world wars, plagues before, pandemics, you know, in the past, and all sorts of challenges. We don't seem to find a way to make life go smoothly. If there really is a God, what's up with that? And that's what I call the God Dilemma. And the God Solution is, you know, God, I've been made very clear to me, what we need to do is to simply redefine who and what God is. Mm. We have defined God as this angry, judgmental, condemning, punishing, even violent deity that sends us to a place of eternal suffering, everlasting damnation for the most trivial of offenses. Not necessarily for killing someone or stealing someone's life savings or raping someone or child abuse. For missing Mass on Sunday, you're going to hell if you don't confess your sins and you don't get to confession ahead of time. If you don't think that'll send a 9-year-old child to confession in a hurry, think again. Because I took it seriously at the age of 9. And I can remember sitting in the confessional, saying the prayers of confession. The poor priest on the other side of the screen, you know, that you can't see each other, but he can hear you, of course. And he's on the other side of the screen listening to this 9-year-old kid. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. My last confession was a week ago, and I missed Mass on Sunday. I went to play baseball. Please help God forgive me. And now that I'm an old person, I'm thinking of this poor priest. What does he say to a 9-year-old kid? Son, do you really believe that? No, he's got to obey the doctrine of the church. So he says, you know, gives me the sign of the cross, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, amen. And he gives me my penance. Go out to the church and say 3 Our Fathers and 3 Hail Marys and 3 Glory Bees, and an act of contrition, and you'll be forgiven. And I go do my penance, and I'm free of having committed that horrible sin of missing Mass on Sunday because my 9-year-old mind thought, wouldn't it be fun to play some baseball? So the God Solution is to redefine God as an entity, self-conscious, self-aware, that can take the form of any sentient being in the universe, but that could be defined by two words, which you mentioned a moment ago. What if we decided that God was pure love? Now, when I give this little talk, Will, in front of audiences, somebody inevitably stands up, or, you know, Mr. Walsh, are you telling me that I sat here for 25 minutes listening to you and your big revelation is that God is love? Everyone says that. Everyone knows that. All the world's religions even agree on that one thing. God is love. I said, hey, relax. I didn't say God is love. I said God is pure love. And there's a huge difference. All right. He says, what's the difference? The difference is that pure love, as opposed to human love, the way we love each other, the way nations say that they're okay with other nations, the way we love our spouses and our children and our family and our friends, pure love needs, requests, requires, asks for, and demands nothing in return.
Unconditional.
Ever. For the simple reason that the highest power in the universe needs nothing. It requires nothing. It's lacking nothing. It doesn't depend on us to give it homage or some kind of energy that will allow it to feel good about itself. You know, we don't need to worship God. God says, you know what? You can worship me if you want to. That's okay. And you don't have to if you don't want to. It's not necessary. I'm not going to send you to hell because you didn't worship me. And I'm not going to send you to hell because you did worship me, but you belong to the wrong religion. Of course, you dummy, you were a Hindu. And Hindus can't go to heaven. Neither can Jews. Neither can anybody except that belong to one religion. And the rest of you guys are going to hell. I know you meant well. I know you were trying. I know you believed in God in your own way, but you're going to hell anyway. What can I tell you? Them's the rules. Them's the rules. And that's the kind of God that we've been asked to believe in. So what the God solution is, and here's why it's a solution, by the way, the God solution is to redefine God, to decide collectively, if all the people of the earth, or just the spiritual people, said, okay, let's agree that God is pure love. Let's agree that God requires, demands, expects, and wishes for, and needs nothing from us. If we decided to take that as our understanding of God, we would overlay it upon our model of human behavior. Because, as I mentioned before, we're behaving with each other the way we presume that God behaves with us. But guess what? That's not how God behaves with us. And if we're wrong about that, if we've been inaccurate all these years in our understanding of that, then we would create a new global ethic, a new ethic that would inform our politics, our economics, our social constructions, and our spirituality. Imagine a spirituality that taught that love is unconditional and requires nothing from the beloved. Imagine just implementing that in your own house, in your own home. The challenge, I've learned the challenge of living with a person, sleeping with a person, sharing life with a person, and needing, requiring, demanding, expecting, and asking for nothing in return. And not feeling injured or upset or damaged in some way if you don't get something in return. Is it possible to love that way? Or is love really a quid pro quo? This for that. I'll give you this, you give me that. It's a trade deal. Like nations have trade deals with other nations. We can have a trade deal with our spouse, with our beloved, with our partner. Let's have a trade deal. And on Valentine's Day, I'll find the perfect Valentine's card. My dearest, my beloved, I trade you very much. And I will never stop trading you, I promise. I will trade you until the end of time. But if you don't trade me, what I expect to get from you in return, the deal is off. And we call that love, Will. And I'm not indicting people. I did that. I did that for 50 years. 50 years I did that. through six marriages until I finally decided, wait a minute, there's clearly something I don't fully understand here. The understanding of which would change everything.
I've got to ask the question, because pure love, I get it. I absolutely get it. I get giving unconditionally. However, what I'm interested to know is, at what point, so there's two angles at this, at what point is operating from pure love, at what point does it become a cause, a root cause of low deserve level? And what I mean by that is...
A root cause of what?
Low deserve level.
Love. So what's love deserve love?
Low, as in the opposite to high. Low is my accent.
Oh, low.
Deserve level, as in your deserve level, as in like self-worth almost.
Okay, and I don't deserve.
So for example, let's say one's in business and they think, well, they've got a service or a product, and they say, well, because I'm operating from pure love, don't give me any money. I'll just give it to you. I'll give it to you for free.
See, you have to include yourself in the group of people that you love unconditionally. So giving things away, when we live inside of an economy that requires the exchange of this thing we call money in order to survive, giving things away would not serve you, nor would it serve, frankly, everybody else. Sooner or later, you'd wind up being on the public dole anyway.
Yeah.
You'd have to go to the government to help you stay alive. So giving things away to say, you know, no, I'll get you, it is not obviously an answer that would work given the economic construction on this planet. There are other planets in the universe, by the way, that don't function in this way, but that's a whole different story. But given the way things are done on this planet, that wouldn't work. But what does work, there are several ways. You can be occasionally that generous. There are people who do pro bono work.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, there are lawyers who do pro bono work. There are many people who do without charging somebody, but they don't do it with everybody in the universe, or they wouldn't be able to do it for anybody.
Yeah. So it's a fair exchange. About fair exchange.
But here's what I do, by the way, with the programs that we do. I have this very interesting thing called pay us what you can. So we have a week's workshop coming up. We do one a month. Every month online, we do a workshop that people all over the world join. And it says on our website, the cost is $120 American, by the way. We're not interested in pounds. That's another whole discussion. Anyway, we say the cost is $120. However, it says on the website, you may pay us whatever you wish and whatever you can. Simply click on the chart below. And on the chart below, it says, I can afford to pay you the full price. I can afford to pay you 90% of the price. I can afford to pay you 80% of the price. I can afford to pay you 70% of the price. It goes right down to zero. I cannot afford to pay you even 1% of the price. I can only afford to give you zero. And people sign up for nothing. Probably 45, I'm told, around 40 or 45% of the people sign up for free. And some sign up for 30%, 25%, 18%, and some sign up for 100%. So we give people the opportunity to tell us what they wish to offer in exchange for the value they anticipate receiving from this program. And that's how I get around the economic requirement. We have to produce some income, or we can't even afford to buy the computer that we're doing the program on. Mm. So here's the deal. But it doesn't unconditional love means that I don't love myself enough to take care of myself. Yeah. Unconditional love means that I will not require you, and I would never say no to somebody who is in desperate need. probably wouldn't say no to anybody.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. What one of the other things that I really want to talk about is pure love has this incredible ability to heal. And one of the things that I heard you say that I just think is so profound, and I'm one of my beliefs is that we tend to judge others on their behaviors and ourselves on our intentions. And one of the things that you said in the book was that when people hurt you, I don't want to get this wrong, but the quote is, what hurts you so bad you feel the need to hurt me to heal. Now, I think of just having that as a rhetorical question that we ask ourselves when people are hurting us is powerful in itself. But to then ask that question to someone that's attempting to hurt us, I mean, talk about a pattern interrupt. That is so powerful.
Yes, it is. I've seen it stop arguments in the middle of an argument. I've been in quarrels with people, you know, with human beings, you know, who I'm interacting with, and they're starting to be abusive, verbally abusive. And I will say to them, excuse me, let me just ask you a question. What hurts you so much that you feel you have to hurt me in order to heal it? Stops the argument right in the middle of the process. People don't expect a question like that. It's the question similar to what the Pope asked the man who shot him 6 times a few years ago. He has since left his body, but not because of those wounds. He actually survived the attempt on his life. This is Pope John Paul II. I'm not making this story up. This actually happened. He was at a motorcade in Rome, and some guy stepped out of the crowd and shot him 6 times. And he miraculously survived his wounds. Then he went to the jail cell of this man who shot him, because they caught him, of course, and threw him in jail for life. You don't try to kill the Pope, not in Italy. So he was sentenced to life in prison, and the Pope went to see him. And of course, he gave the assassin his papal blessing. And after blessing the man, he said, can you help me understand? I'm not going to condone it. I don't agree with it. I hope that people don't repeat that, but I want to understand. What could cause you to do such a thing? Why would you want to kill me? And the guy told him all the reasons why he thought that the Catholic Church was hurting his own people, his own culture, his own religion. And the Pope said, I understand. I understand why you would do that. Given your thought and your sense of injury, I understand. Again, I don't condone it. I don't agree with it. I don't approve of it. I don't recommend it, but at least I understand. And out of that came an enormous statement that came to me in conversations with God. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. Now, this guy and the Pope became pen pals. It's a true story. I'm not making this up. They wrote letters back and forth from the Vatican to the jail cell, from the Vatican to the jail cell for years. They became pen pals, talking to each other in letters on a regular basis, until after 7 years, the Pope actually asked the civil authorities to pardon the man. He said he served 7 years. That's enough. And he asked the civil authorities to grant the man a full pardon and a complete release, which the authorities did. Because when the civil authorities are given a request by the Pope in Italy, I promise you they don't say no. So they released his assassin. Now, can we release the person across the room when they're not giving us what we thought they should be giving us? Or worse yet, when they treat us in a way that we don't think we deserve? Mm-hmm. Are we able to look at that person and say, I actually need nothing in particular from you. Mm-hmm. I love you so much. I don't love you because of what you can give me. If that's why I love you, I'm loving me through you. But I love you without getting anything back. And if you should decide to love me in a particular way, wonderful. I can receive that, but I don't require it. Guess what? Nobody leaves a person who treats them like that. Mm. I promise you.
Yeah, I can imagine. On that note, because it's segueing in lovely, one of our community...
Did you hear that? Did you hear him use the word segue? You don't even know how to spell segue, and he actually used it in the sentence.
One of our members, Stephanie Beresford, she asked a question. We had a few people ask questions, and some of them I've selected. I particularly like this one, but it ties in with what we were just speaking about really nicely. How do you personally handle people that challenge your beliefs, and how do you accept or challenge the belief of others?
Well, I don't challenge the belief of others. I have no need to. I simply allow them to believe what they want to believe. I don't have a need for anyone to believe anything in particular. Least of all, do I have a need for them to believe what I believe. So how I deal with people who don't believe what I believe and who challenge my beliefs is fair enough. Fair enough. Let me give you an example. I was to give a talk a few years ago in Cleveland, and when I pulled up in front of the venue, it was a big auditorium, it must have been maybe 300 or 400 people there, for a lecture. There was a pastor there with members of his church, and they were picketing in front of the church. It was maybe 8 or 10 people carrying signs that I was the instrument of the devil and don't listen to a word I had to say, and you know, all the rest. So I got out of the car and I said to the first person, is your pastor here? They said, yeah, he's right over here. So I went over to the pastor and I said, thank you for being here. Thank you for believing what you believe strongly enough that you would spend an evening of your life walking the streets with signs to protest what I'm doing. Thank you for finding a way to announce your beliefs, which is not hurtful to others, doesn't injure others, is not damaging to anyone, but simply a civil way to say you don't agree with me. Would you do me a favor? He said, what? I said, would you come in to my talk and share the stage with me? And how about if I talk for 10 minutes and you talk for 10 minutes, and I talk for 10 minutes and you talk for 10 minutes, and you can say why you disagree with what I'm saying and give your point of view, and I'll give my point of view, and we'll share points of view for the entire lecture. He said, really? You would do that? I said, absolutely. I'm not right. I'm just Neil. I'm not right. I'm not necessarily wrong either. I just have a point of view. Let's really shock the hell out of the audience. I mean, shock the hell right out of the audience. So he came in with me. He said, okay. And he came in with me and we gave a lecture. I talked, he talked, I talked, he talked. My view, his view, my view, his view. It was fantastic. The audience didn't know what to make of it. They had never seen such a thing. I explained to them, of course, this guy's out front picketing. You may have seen him picketing when you came in with his congregation with holding up the signs, let's hear what he has to say. Let's give him a chance to share his point of view. At the end of the night, we hugged each other in the middle of the stage. Two guys just going, good job. Good job. We can disagree agreeably. Of course, as you can imagine, we got a standing ovation. It was way more than any audience could ever have expected. That's how I handle people who disagree with me.
What a way to do it. So, Stephanie, there you go. There's your answer. So the thing that I would love for us to look at finishing up on, and this has been a phenomenal conversation, so thank you so much, Neil. I'm extremely grateful for your time. You are someone that has for decades now shared wisdom and insights that's had a profound impact on people's lives. And when I first heard this term, I was driving along listening to one of your books, and I went, yes, Neil, you are the epitome of an idea hero. And that for, and I was just, and I loved the term. And I know part of your wish, if you like, now is to have more people become idea heroes. But for people that have not heard that before, or what an idea hero is, what is it?
Well, Galileo was an idea hero. He said in 1603, the earth revolves around the sun. He was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. He was condemned, and he was thrown into house arrest. They didn't put him in jail, but they did put him under house arrest. And he died under house arrest because they demanded that he recant. Because the Catholic Church said no. In those days, the Catholic Church taught that the sun revolved around the earth, that the earth was the center of the universe, and that human beings were the masters of the universe. So his teaching, his scientific discovery that the earth revolves around the sun was, you know, apostasy to the Catholic Church, and they excommunicated him 356 years later. The church retracted its excommunication, reversed their decision, and released him from their condemnation. 356 years later, the church said, you know what? We've come to our senses. He was right. Mm-hmm. But he was an idea hero because he put his idea out there knowing ahead of time that it would meet with incredible levels of disagreement among the highest authorities. Ignatz Semmelweis was a doctor, a Hungarian doctor. He was practicing medicine in a hospital in Vienna, and he noticed that the babies were dying. Infant mortality rate was way, way too high. And he looked into why, and he realized that there was no attempt by doctors to sterilize their hands between procedures. Doctors were coming from the morgue into the birthing room, and they weren't sterilizing their hands because there was no such thing as sterilization. It was a brand new idea. In fact, medicine at that time did not even believe in the existence of germs. They didn't think that such a thing as germs existed. So when Semmelweis brought this up and told them that we should, what if we started washing our hands in some kind of alcoholic sterilization liquid, they told him he was crazy. They drummed him out of the medical profession. He died in an insane asylum. But he was an idea hero because he advanced an idea that he knew ahead of time no one was going to agree with. And they ran him out of medicine. Barbara McClintock, in case you think only men are idea heroes, Barbara McClintock is an idea heroine. She decided in 1944 that there was such a thing as jumping genes. She discovered jumping genes. She was a geneticist. And in her work as a geneticist, she discovered what creates the different characteristics, why they can't be evenly tracked and predicted characteristics, hereditary characteristics. She said, genes actually jump from chromosome to chromosome. They told her she was out of her mind. They told her it was nonsense, that her idea of jumping genes was simply nonsense. Barbara McClintock, please stop putting this out there in the journals and in the articles you're writing. It's nonsense. But she didn't stop writing about it until 1983, when she didn't have to write about it anymore because she won the Nobel Prize for physiology and medicine. But she was an idea heroine, someone who said, no, you know what? I'm sorry. I know this is inconvenient, but my friend Al Gore would call it an inconvenient truth. I know this is an inconvenient truth, but jumping genes exist. And if we study them even more closely, we can begin to predict hereditary inconsistencies from one generation to the next of all life forms, not just people, but corn, grains, harvests. Imagine the help that's been to farmers in the past 50 years. So an idea hero is a person who says, you know what? I have learned or come to discover or come to understand something that I know in advance there's going to be a lot of opposition to. Many people, not a few, but probably the largest number of people are going to disagree with. But I'm going to be an idea hero. I'm going to embrace the idea and put it out there anyway. And here's an interesting idea that would be theologically revolutionary, that everybody in the world's 4,000 religions are going to disagree with. God needs, requires, demands, and commands nothing from us whatsoever. God will not judge us, will not condemn us, and will not punish us to everlasting damnation, ever. That's a theologically revolutionary idea. Not a new idea. It's been said before, but it hasn't been practiced before. It hasn't been widely shared before because we haven't had enough idea heroes. But if we could find enough idea heroes to say, this is what we have had wrong all along. I wrote a book a few years ago called God's Message to the World, : You've Got Me All Wrong. So what we have to do now is to share with people everywhere. You know what? We've got it all wrong. We've not understood the fundamental nature of God. Therefore, we have not understood the fundamental nature of us. We actually think we're separate from God, but we're not separate from God. We are that which God is, simply in individuated form. We're a wave on the ocean of God. A wave is not separate from the ocean. It's not something other than the ocean. It's simply an arising of the ocean in magnificent individuated form. And when that expression is complete, the wave recedes back into the ocean whence it came, even as we shall do. I could, of course, be wrong about all of this.
Incredible, absolutely incredible. And the biggest impact, if everybody was to adopt this and all religions were to adopt this, what do you perceive that would happen to the planet? Or the people
a new global ethic, a new, as I mentioned earlier in our talk, a new global ethic would be found, would be created, because it would form a basis, a new ethical basis for the way we interact with each other, because we would have changed our mind about how God interacts with us. And then we would say, okay, if our opportunity is to imitate, to model the behavior of divinity, then we would necessarily interact with each other differently as well. and we would have an entirely different political ethic, economic ethic, social ethic, and global ethic. We would change our minds about the best way we know to behave with each other. Right now, we're acting like children, Will. We've got heads of state. I mean, I'm not talking about some senator or some congressman. I'm talking about heads of state in countries talking to each other like playhound bullies. Mm. Our missiles are bigger than your missiles. You better not cross my path. We have chiefs of state, presidents of countries, using insults, playground insults with other people, talking about their opponents because they have big ears, and insulting somebody because of the size of their ears and laughing about it. And we call that leadership. So what would change in this world? We would alter our ideas about who and what we are, because we've altered our understanding of who and what God is. It's revolutionary. Be careful. We might. Do you realize that we have had some form of violent interaction on this planet for 92% of recorded history? No. We have had violent wars, turmoil on this planet for 92% of recorded history. We can't even get along with each other.
And that's one of the benefits in your belief of this being the case, is if we have this new ethic and we have this single statement of spiritual truth that all the religions agree to, we will produce peace and happiness on the planet.
I think that we will come very close to creating a dynamic, an economic dynamic, a political dynamic, a social dynamic, yes, and a spiritual dynamic that could set the stage for the kind of peace and prosperity and love that we have been told is our ultimate destiny. We've been told that that's what we have been designed to experience, but we haven't found a way to create it yet. But I think, yes, yeah, if we became idea heroes, and if enough of us said, you know what, wait a minute, what if we have it all wrong? And that's the question that I keep asking people all over the world. I've gone from country to country to country. I've really been all over the world, from Moscow to Tokyo, even London, and Buenos Aires, and to capitals all over the world in the past 25 years, asking a single question. Is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here about God, about life, and about each other, the understanding of which would change everything? If the answer is yes, yes, it's possible, now the field is wide open, and we finally can begin acting as if we truly are individuations of divinity. So here's the challenge that I leave people with when I give my little talks around the world, which we haven't done many of in the past 2 years because of the pandemic, but maybe we'll hit the road again someday soon. In the meantime, we have opportunities such as this delicious opportunity that you've offered me here to make the same statement. I invite people to make this statement to themselves. The first time they see anybody in any given day, maybe the first time you see the person across the pillow, or the first time you see the person across the street, or the first time you see the person across town, or the first time you see the person across the world. But to make this statement in your head, don't say it out loud because very few people will understand, but say it in your mind. The first time you interact with an individual tomorrow, your life will be made better today for having encountered me. I promise you. And I dare myself to say that. The first time I see anyone, whether it's the beloved person on the other pillow or the total stranger across town, the guy at the post office, the lady at the coffee shop, your life will be made better today because I passed this way. I promise you. And then I find a way to make that true. And I don't go to sleep very many nights anymore wondering what this is all about. I'm very clear. I could, of course, be wrong about all of it. And I remember the words of some guy whose ideas I admire. He said once, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you and do good to those who would do evil to you. And if a man asks you for your coat, give him your shirt as well. And if a man slaps you on the right cheek, turn and offer him your left. And if a man asks you to walk 1 mile with him, go with him too. Bunch of really good ideas. So that's how I think the world would change if we all decided to be who we truly are. It's a big dare. It's a big challenge. Do I meet the challenge? Do I accomplish what I seek to accomplish all the moments of my life? No. Am I closer than ever I was? Yeah.
Amazing. Neil, thank you so much for sharing your incredible insights, your personal stories, and what's been a truly inspiring conversation. Thank you so much. I'm truly, truly grateful for conversations with Neil Donald Walsh. Today. So, and I'm sure everybody listening in is as well. For people that have been thinking, wow, this is incredible, I'd love to connect with you. Where can people find you? Where can people connect with you? Where can people find out more?
They can simply go to, speaking of connecting with me, cwgconnect.com. And there you'll find me. And I have a column there called Ask Neil, where people can ask me any questions they wanted to ask me. Talk with me about anything they want to discuss, explore more deeply the understandings in conversations with God, and stay connected with the energy if it serves them to do so. I have no need for anyone to do so. I'm not here to sell anyone anything, convince anyone of anything, change anyone's mind about anything. But if it serves them to stay connected, I've provided a way for them to do so. And I've made certain that I would always be available to anyone who wanted to stay connected in that way. Not with me personally, but with the energy of the messages that have been given to all of us in the conversations of God dialogues. Because that's where this is coming from. Just to be clear as we say goodbye, Everything I've said for the past 90 minutes is not stuff that's coming out of Neil Donald Walsh's mind. It's not like, I don't want people to think, oh, what an interesting guy. What a wonderful guy. See, you know what? It's all from the 4,000 pages of the Conversations with God books. It's about the message, always the message. You might find it interesting to notice that unlike some of the other authors in the world who write spiritual books, you won't find my cover. I'm sorry, I misstated that. You won't find my picture on the cover of one of my 39 books. You might find Mary Ann's here and there. You might find Deepak's picture on the cover of his book. Not making him wrong, I'm just noticing. You might find, you know, the pictures of other authors on the covers of their books. And my publishers have asked me to put my picture on the cover of my books. I says, no, no, we're not going there. We're not going there. It's not about me. It's about the message.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Well, for everybody listening, I do highly recommend reading or listening to Conversation with God. All nine of them. I think there's nine in total. And then also most recently, and as you've already alluded to, it's not 4,000 pages. It is a few hundred pages, and it's a very interesting, inspiring read. Of course, the most recent, The God Solution, much of which we've touched on today, but there's so much more in the book that I highly recommend people go and check it out. So definitely go and do that for everybody that's listening. Neil, again, I just want to say a huge thank you. I'm grateful for your time, your insights, your wisdom, and sharing what you have done today. And I look forward to hopefully having you again back on the show and speaking again in the not too distant future.
Be careful. You issue an invitation like that to me and you're not going to shut me up. You're in
absolutely
big trouble.
Not.
You're in
yeah,
big
absolutely
trouble.
Not. We'll get you back. We'll get you back. Neil, thanks again. And everyone that's been listening, until next time, make it happen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Make It Happen with Will Polston podcast. Make sure you join Will's free Facebook group, the Make It Happen community. Please support the show by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or Google Play. Share this episode with at least one friend you think would benefit from it, and give Will a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. Until next time, make it happen.